You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
We are on the eve of Freedom Day, and there's lots in this country to celebrate. We shouldn't be glib historically about what it is that we managed, at least politically, to defeat in 1994. But of course, we also need to be critical and honest about freedom. What is freedom? How do we decide whether or not we are truly free as individuals and as a society? And do some stock taking. You know, the constitution that we adopted was such a wonderful vision for what it means to live in a just and inclusive society. But we know that for many years now, we've had to be vigilant in minding the gap between the vision of a free society and the reality of daily struggles of so many people, millions of people in this country. And I want you to listen to my brilliant guest that we're going to have this hour. We've got so many people that will be dropping in. Some will be in the studio for the entire time. And of course, I want you to call in and I want you to reflect for me. How free do you feel? What counts for you as freedom? And then maybe something a little bit unorthodox from my side. I know it's controversial. I'm using the hashtag unfreedom because while we must take stock of what we have achieved, I also think it's very important that we talk about the ways in which we are not free. And I'm just sort of calling it unfreedom. So hashtag unfreedom, and I'll pick up some of your thoughts as well as we go along. Let me introduce the guests for you. Pearl Totsetsi is back. We're not going to be talking about Barbie today. We're going to be talking about freedom. She's, of course, lifestyle editor, columnist at the Sunday Times. And we thoroughly enjoyed her the last time she was on the show. Pearl, thanks so much for coming back on the show. It's lovely seeing you.
Thanks for having me.
And nice shoes.
Thank you. I put them on just for you.
Do you think Barbie would wear those?
Yes, she would.
Probably, right? Straight from Barbie's closet. And then we've got Nolazi Tosini, who, of course, is at Power 98.7. She's a radio producer. She's a poet, a writer, and just fabulous. Nolazi, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me, Eusebius. It's always a pleasure.
On the line from Ekapa, we've got Judge Albie Sachs. The last time we had him on was on the Literature Corner. Albie, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. I really appreciate it.
I'm not wearing any shoes at all, in fact.
Touché. Let's start with you then, Albie. When it comes to freedom historically, there's a lot of contestation in the year now. A lot of young South Africans are rightly agitating for change more quickly than it is happening. You've been in the game for a very long time, fighting against apartheid, but also as a jurist having to grapple with freedom. What is freedom for you? How do we decide the success criteria to know that Albie is free? What would that mean?
Okay, the first part is easy. Our slogan used to be freedom in our lifetime. And just from my own life, I was thrown into jail without trial, detention without trial for a long, long time, sleep deprivation. My books were banned three times. My thesis for a doctorate at Sussex University banned three times. I was banned, and the book was banned, and it quoted banned people like Oliver Tambo. People couldn't move, they couldn't vote, they couldn't get the jobs that they wanted. So that part was spectacularly successful. We destroyed the instruments of apartheid, the divisions in our society, but we did more than that. We gave the vote, ensured the vote went to everybody. We had freedom of choice. We had freedom to have programs like the one that we're on now. I can say I'm a Marxist, Leninist, whatever it is, just on this radio program, I'm not going to go to jail. And you can laugh or shout back at me, whatever it might be. So we're a very, very free society in terms of opinion and expression. We don't allow the K word. We don't allow that kind of destructive thing that gets at our humanity, but by and large we're one of the freest and most open societies in the world in terms of expression. And for me, what's so important is we've got the instruments now to have the second wave of liberation. We don't have to use guns. We don't have to send tanks into the street. We can vote. We can mobilize. We can demand changes. So those are the two fantastically important and significant and very South African foundations of freedom, getting rid of the power structures and having the instruments to now deal with the question of the land, deal with economic opportunities, and deal with all that covert sense of superiority that sadly still so many people from certain communities still have in relation to their place on this earth and in South Africa.
Absolutely.
So huge gains made, and we use those gains not just to celebrate the past, but to use the instruments that have been given us, the possibilities, the freedom we've got to get much, much more freedom, deeper freedom, more meaningful freedom.
Absolutely. Nolazi, I'm going to bring you in here. What does freedom mean to you?
For me, freedom is the ability to self-determine at any given point. It is the existence of a space where I or any other person can exercise and performatively showcase our agency. Mm. And I don't know if that sounds too esoteric, but it's the ability to be. And I use ability quite deliberately because it's more than just the right to be. I believe that everyone is born free. Mm. And then we slowly, because of structural issues and societal things, we become more and more unfree as we go through our lives. Mm-hmm. But so the right is inherent to freedom. So it's the ability to exercise that agency and the ability to access your freedom. That's what it is for me.
And I like the way you want to tie it to happiness. And one can, I suppose, also use other concepts in ethics, you know, like also the ability to, as Nolazi says, to lead a certain kind of life, a meaningful life, a life with integrity. Pearl, just reflect for me what that means for you, because once we get into the nuts and bolts, sadly, I can think of many people who live under conditions of poverty in this country, for example, for whom Unfreedom Day is more apt tomorrow.
I agree with a lot of what Nolazi said, and for me that agency and that ability is interchangeable with happiness. I think it's the ability, as she says, to sort of control your destiny, and not in the sense that there wouldn't be external factors where you can't control everything, but it shouldn't be a thing where you're restrained by where you live or who you can relate to and who you know and what you have access to. It should be where we sort of all have similar kind of access, and we can use that access to sort of make decisions that suit the kind of lives that we want to live.
Do you feel free yourself as Pearl?
I feel like I'm freer than most people in the country.
But you don't have land.
No, not yet.
Judge Sex, I want to come back to you here because we have you only for the first half of the show. And I wanted to ask you how you feel about the brilliant jurisprudence we have that try to wrestle conceptually with what freedom means. And yet, if we just walk to different parts of Cape Town where you are located, for example, we see exactly what Nolwazi is talking about. We see incredible structural inequality. We see millions of South Africans on the margins of society. For them, political freedom doesn't mean much because it doesn't fill your tummy and it can't guarantee living the kind of life filled with self-determination and happiness that my studio guests are saying should be the genuine substantive criteria for what it means to be free.
You know, in a very strange way, we felt so free fighting for freedom. We felt an energy, a solidarity, a connectedness, and I think that's what's very much missing now. It wasn't hardship of conditions. It was the, if you like, the brilliance of hope. And my response is yes, it's appalling and unacceptable that we have massive inequality side by side with luxurious wealth, but. For me, the freedom we have now is also the freedom to act politically, to act culturally, to act socially, to act experimentally. That's, in that sense, I don't think the problem is one of freedom. The problem is much more one that's in terms of choice. We can vote, we can speak, we can agitate, we can express our sexuality, we can express our inner selves in all sorts of ways that other countries you can't do. But there are these structural issues that impact so severely on the lives of people, and the impact of drugs and gangs and unemployment and you know, these things have to be tackled. So I would say don't demand our freedom. We have freedom. Use our freedom to change these things that impact so severely on us with integrity and with honesty. What gives me a lot of hope now is that theme of integrity is coming back into public life. And I think the actions that are being taken to deal with corruption go well beyond simply saving resources and having good people and competent people in charge. It's restoring honor to public life. And I think without honor, the inequalities become intolerable. With honor, then you can mobilize, you can work together, you can maybe recapture some of that solidarity that fired us up in the most difficult days. At the same time, it's thrilling for me to hear the other participants speaking about the importance of individual personal expression and self-determination. We need all these things. It's not only full stomachs and a shelter. And by the way, we had rain, heavy rain last night. That strange sound that I haven't heard for a long time. But that same rain will be now creating terrible conditions for people living in some of the very poor and damp areas. Absolutely. These are the things that we have to tackle, but not just from the top and not just through critiques, but the people themselves to feel the energy, the solidarity, the comfort, and the inspiration to do something about it.
Now, Razi, you are smiling generously, but you're also nodding negatively to parts of what LB is saying.
Yeah, you know, quite respectfully, I would disagree with the Justice Sachs on the issue of unfreedom and freedom. And I think that what he's highlighting in terms of for the freedom of speech, the freedom of movement, the kind of freedoms that are guaranteed by our constitution in this country is very, very true. And I don't mean to diminish the huge jump from an apartheid regime to a democratic South Africa, because that is important and those freedoms are enshrined in our constitution. But I do think that it's not enough for jurisprudence to exist around these freedoms. We need to speak about whether or not people can actively access these freedoms that are enshrined in our constitution. And I believe that they cannot. I do not believe that LGBTIQ community in this country can freely access their freedoms. I do not think that black people, in particular black women, can freely access their freedoms. And in that way, we are unfree. Not because the freedom doesn't exist, not because we don't have this amazing constitution, but we are unable to make our freedom manifest. If I go to a police station to report a rape and nothing is done about that, then I can't exercise my freedom because there's no way to manifest it. The systems and regulations that are supposed to be in place to ensure that my freedom is not trampled upon, and if it is, I get recourse, do not work for certain sectors of our society. And we need to be honest about that while still being hopeful or I don't know, grateful for the fact that we are where we are at. We're not living under the apartheid regime, but we're also not free. Just because media freedom exists, just because freedom of speech exists, doesn't mean that people can access and therefore exercise those freedoms.
Oh, yeah, a lot of umming and arming there. You can respond, Justice Sachs. I mean, she does have a point, doesn't she? I suppose part of the problem is that many of us over-invested in the final adopted constitution in 1996, forgetting that bottom-up politics still need to happen.
Now, can I say it's a constitution for transformation? It's not just a beautiful document at a moment that celebrates the end of apartheid. It's a constitution that presupposes that now we will be free to bring about the changes, the structural changes. So the speaker disagrees with me. I don't disagree with her. In fact, I agree completely. But those freedoms are not just freedom of speech and movement and voting, important though they are. They're freedoms to mobilize. They're freedoms to go on strike. They're freedoms to march in the streets. They're freedoms to criticize. They're freedoms to do something about it. That we didn't have before. And what I'm saying is we must use those freedoms. We must organize. We must mobilize to get the access that we require to demand the performances we require. And why I stress the importance of getting rid of corruption is that's the alternative. That's the alternative to what the Constitution envisages. It envisages a mobilized, conscientized, active citizenry. I think that's where we come together, doing something about it, not simply lamenting that things are bad, but doing something about it, engaging with that same dynamism and energy and determination that we had to overthrow apartheid, now to give the access, to ensure the real access that is the promise of the Constitution. It's not the guarantee of the Constitution.
Let's go to Noortuk. Penny, good morning. You're listening to this conversation. What are some of the thoughts coming up for you, Penny?
Hi, Eusebius, and welcome. Great to speak to you and your guest. You know, I'm from a very privileged white society in Noortuk, and I approach Freedom Day with a sense of absolute sorrow and sadness, because having freedom doesn't get you a hot lunch. And I know we've got power of speech and there's democracy and all of that, but I just feel so little is being done for those in our country that really, really need it. And I do, I come from Noortuk, where we are so community focused. We do so much for people who are in need, but it's not enough. You know, I just wish more people would open their hearts and their minds. And if you can give, just, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, but just give. I think if we as South Africans and those who are the haves, if we can just turn and look what is happening and just spread more love, more, just give more to the have-nots. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Penny. I'll get Pearl and Noloazi to respond in a second. Coquette, good morning.
Yeah, how are you doing?
How's the farming going?
Yeah, it's going well. You know? And then I struck a point at me, because, you know, I'm here driving on my land, and I'm thinking, I have the freedom to farm. I have the freedom to put seed in the ground and let it come up and solve this and, you know, have land. But going back to your point, and I think this is where Judge affects me, this is the nuances in Nolazi's point, or what Nolazi's trying to make, is the fact that the unfreedom aspect of it, to say that not everybody has that opportunity to, you know, to really sort of recognize their freedom. Because you mentioned a very personal point, and he said that they fought so that people could have the freedom to work wherever they want to work. But at the same time, what they negated to sort of understanding that is that the people who hold the power, so the people, the very same people who were there during apartheid, who hold the power, who weren't hiring African people or people of color during apartheid, are still the very same captains of industry that we have in today's economy.
So, but, Coquette, without not to be kumbaya, but for me, the points raised by Judge Sex and by Noloazi are compatible and, in fact, mutually reinforcing.
Yeah.
It's all how you see the Constitution. The Constitution is a standard against which you periodically measure yourself to see how you are getting on achieving that ideal standard of a decent society. You can't eat the Constitution. You can't farm the Constitution. The Constitution is not an answer to homophobia in our taverns. It's not going to make a black lesbian woman in Khayelitsha safer. And I think we thought that it is a magic wand, and it's not, and it never was meant to be.
And just as a slight pushback to you, you say yes, regarding that specific point, and I think this is really missing the subtlety that Noloazi was trying to point out, to say that it's one thing if you're within that position to exercise the freedom. So, for instance, let's not negate the importance or the significance of things like social capital, things like a person's background, things like the system of schooling that one went to, and the access to the type of people that one has in the inner circle, so that you get a job, and, for instance, in this tech or whatever. So let's not sort of put it down to good old-fashioned meritocracy and say that, you know what, if you do your best and you work really hard and, you know, you dot your I's and you cross your T's in this country, you too can get ahead. It's not like that. There are systems of obstruction in place, even particularly to us as young entrepreneurs, where you struggle to access capital because, you know, like maybe first or second generation people who are now, you know, credit-driven.
Okay, absolutely. I hear you, Coquette. Pearl, what are some of the thoughts coming up for you? A lot has happened in the last couple of minutes.
Particularly on the issue of mobilization, that stood out to me because I think mobilization is unequal. There's a hierarchy there too. We recognize some forms of mobilization more than others. We accept some forms of mobilization more than others. And some mobilization is more policed than others. So I think on paper, it's fantastic. Yes, we have the ability and the freedom to mobilize, but the truth is not everybody gets it. And the fact that, for instance, the myth of white genocide would get more attention than when a black lesbian woman is murdered says a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, you wanted to respond to Penny Noortuk.
Yes, in fact, I would have wanted to ask a question, if you will allow me, Eusebius, just in general to your listeners, in particular the ones who are like Penny, who understand that they are privileged, who feel very badly about it, and, you know, have all the appropriate responses. What I wanted to find out from Penny is how much she's willing to then give up to fix the situation. And I don't mean charitable giving, which is what she was talking about. I mean, how much of that privilege are you willing to relinquish for the situation to change? Because it's all good and well to feel badly about the fact that people don't have food in their stomachs and freedom doesn't give them this and it doesn't give them that. But you also need to understand your role as an actor in perpetuating that situation, you know. And I always find it very interesting where when I hear white people acknowledge their privilege but then are very anti the conversation around land that is happening in this country. That is very dichotomous. It doesn't make sense. You can't acknowledge your privilege and then not want to have a conversation about how you then give it up.
She said she'd love to give.
Yeah, but charitably. She wants to give a blanket here and there, 500 there. No, I mean, are you willing to give up some of the land that you inherited in that space? Are you willing to allow your fancy suburb to become mixed housing area where poorer people have access to your private schools with their children? Are you able to, are you willing to make the sacrifices that are required, to ensure that this country becomes more equitable?
Absolutely. We've got 2 minutes left with you, Judge Sex. I wanted to ask you this question. We have the freedom to mobilize, but as Pearl rightly says, there are also material conditions that impact the levels of cooperation. Sometimes we are so focused on our divisions, we do not even know how to strategically cooperate to get rid of someone like Jacob Zuma, for example. At a very high level, sketch for me the strategies that you think we can yet employ, drawing on our history, particularly the 60s through to the early 90s, to again be in a position where we cooperate for the common good, despite the fact that identitarian politics divide us.
You've used up most of my 2 minutes in the question. Now, first of all, the Constitution is a standard, but it's also empowering. Secondly, that is the piece of paper. Now it's up to us. We got the Constitution through struggle. We must implement it through struggle. It sounds like an incantation, but sometimes incantations are necessary.
Sure.
But we need that kind of sense of solidarity. We need much more hard talking. It's terrific to hear the question being thrown back to Penny, I think it was, because really white South Africa now has to face up to the necessity to that the country belongs to all. There's got to be a huge amount of redistribution and sharing in all sorts of ways, not just pieces of land, but access to the schools, access to jobs, access to training, access to the realms of the imagination. But we are moving. Things have changed enormously. I think they're going to change much, much more. I would urge less rancor, less spitefulness, less personalizing, more human solidarity. That's what really got us through. More looking into each other's eyes, more learning to enjoy the otherness of other people and not to see it as a kind of a threat. To celebrate the diversity of our country, to certainly invest in our culture, our dance, our music, expression, film, literature, broadcasting. These are very broad things. Maybe as an ex-judge, I'm speaking now rather than as an ex-revolutionary, but I think those are qualities that our society needs very much.
Absolutely.
But I would say celebrate our freedom, use our freedom, lament, detest, denounce the unfreedoms that you're mentioning. There's always a tension between freedom and unfreedom. But don't denounce the idea of freedom and don't belittle the rights that we've got, because they really keep the society open and make it possible for us to mobilize, to organize, to make the very point so beautifully made by your listeners.
Okay, we're gonna leave it there for today. Judge Sex, I'm going to leave you to go put on some shoes now. Thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you.
CBS Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
We're having the most wonderful panel discussion about freedom. Hashtag unfreedom. Lots of your tweets coming through under that. I'm going to read them in a second. And we're taking stock ahead of Freedom Day. What does freedom consist in? How do you know that you're free as an individual and as society? And what can we do crucially to still reduce the gap between that beautiful vision of a free society that is expressed in the Constitution and the reality of so many obstacles in the way in which you and I still live in this weird and wonderful country of ours. Also joining us now is Bandile Ngidi, who is the co-founder of the NGO Rethink Africa. Bandile, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank thank you very much. I hope you guys can hear me. I'm actually in a rural area.
Okay. What? Marking out your land?
Yeah, exactly. I've been here for 3 days, running some workshops on women's land rights.
Nice.
In Mount Ailes.
Okay. Great stuff. Hope you're not doing too much mansplaining. Daniel McLaren, who's a budget analyst with Section 27. Daniel, how's it?
Morning, Eusebius. Thanks for having me on.
It's only a pleasure. And then one of my other favorite South Africans, I'm just having a festival of favorites today in the show, is, of course, a former Justice Zak Yacoob, who should be resting, but has generously agreed to be part of this conversation. Zak, goeiemôre, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, and hello to everybody. This is a wonderful thing to do while I rest.
Absolutely. Bandile, I want to start with you. Let's talk about economic freedom. It's very hard to take seriously civil and political rights if we do not have land, if we do not have the resources with which to live the kind of lives that my guests have been outlining. How are we getting on as a society when it comes to economic freedom?
I don't think we're not doing very well. You know, just thinking back to in the last couple of months, the World Bank reports policy confirmed South Africa as the world's most unequal nation. And if you just listen to radio media constantly, there are many, many measures in which that show that we fall short from the standard or the envisioned economic freedom that we have. And it's famously sort of difficult to understand why. If you force me to sort of have to explain this, I think it sounds cliche, but really is an issue of economic vision and economic stability. I think one of the major problems, or the major problem, as you have to distill it, is that we're a country with a lot of economic potential from the mineral resources and, you know, technology and human capital. But there's so much uncertainty and there's a lack of a clear, committed vision and, a state that can actually implement the vision and say, this is how we're going.
Sure.
And this is the direction that we're going in. So it's very difficult to celebrate Freedom Day in the context of the fact that economics, is probably the most important. Material conditions, as your guest has been saying, are the most important in order to realize freedom,
Dutch Yacoob, I always have mixed feelings about Freedom Day. I'm sort of like that in-between weird generation where we're born right at the end of the 70s, just turned 39. I'm not glib about what it is that we achieved in terms of political freedom in 1994. And yet I have to confess that I also accept the compelling agitation on the part of South Africans younger than me under the age of 35, who are also restless about the indignities that we continue to experience in our country. Where do you sit on this one? Because you've got a long view of history, and I'm not calling you old. And yet at the same time, of course, the empirical realities are that we are not yet in the nirvana that we had hoped we'd be in 20 plus years into democracy.
Yeah, I had not hoped to be in any nirvana. Our constitution provides for a number of freedoms. The freedom and security of the person, which we have, freedom of movement, which we have, freedom of expression, which we have, of religion we have, of trade and occupation we have. But the most important freedom, and tomorrow is the day that denotes it, is the right to vote, is really the freedom to vote. And it was in this age that it was that freedom, the freedom to vote, which will be used by us appropriately and properly, in conjunction with political parties, to choose the people who really represent us and who, as government, will make a difference. So that is the first problem. The problem is that right to vote has been compromised because political parties, as they always do in all countries, take advantage of poor and vulnerable people to manipulate them to do things which are not necessarily in their best interest.
But
so it's a right to vote for me, which is fundamental. The second thing I want to say very quickly is that economic freedom is not really about freedom, because our constitution is not really about liberty. It has no self-standing right to freedom. Our constitution is about freedom, dignity, and equality, which have to be balanced against each other. Many say it's a libertarian constitution, which means that everyone can do exactly as they wish. That's not the point. Our freedoms are limited and can be, for the sake of society. But most importantly, if we have to balance between freedom, equality, and dignity, I would put equality and dignity and the achievement of that slightly above freedom.
I agree.
Because that's where your economic freedom actually comes from. So it's not an unqualified freedom. It's freedom, dignity, equality, and freedom.
Yeah.
And we must remember that. And we need to use our vote to do it. We need to limit our own freedom. Mm. And finally, the Constitution not only provides us with opportunities to do things for ourselves, I think our Constitution provides us with a duty. It's a launching pad. It gives to all of us who can do it a duty to improve the quality of life of all our people, to increase freedom, to increase equality, and to increase people's power. Because what we need over and above the law is a social revolution where we start beginning slowly to live according to the values of our Constitution ourselves, and then gently and carefully change the minds of others.
Absolutely.
The gay and lesbian problem you were talking about, the attitude to poor people. There are 20 people in this country who think that poor people are poor only because they are lazy. They don't understand the structural elements. So what we really need to do is change the hearts and minds of our people to make sure that we all begin to live the values of our Constitution. So I'm not so much interested in the opportunities the Constitution gives us. I think that the Constitution imposes on all of us, including on me, a duty to do everything we can to change these values slowly and deliberately so that freedom can be increased.
Tena, I want to bring you in here. I love what Judge Yakub is saying. In fact, I would go even so far as to say for myself, but that's another debate to have, that not only are equality and dignity, two values that are more primary than freedom, that dignity, in fact, is the most preeminent, which is why in our jurisprudence, the one right that can never be limited, not even during a state of emergency, is dignity. But then I think about the work that you guys at Section 27, we think about the outcomes in the Michael Komape case, for example. And then I think to myself, well, if dignity can never be limited, why is it that this particular family suffered the indignity of even the judiciary, or one particular court case, not the entire judiciary, doesn't respect the inherent self-worth that Michael Komape had. And with that, the fact that you are due constitutional and other forms of compensation to make amends for when your dignity is trampled on. So talk to me about the work that Section 27 does and what that says about where we are at in terms of this wonderful jurisprudence on paper.
Sure, you say this. I mean, I think you've certainly hit the nail on the head in terms of the awful case of Michael Komape, as I'm sure all the listeners are well aware of by now. You know, and there's probably few cases since our transition to democracy which bring to light the real struggles of people, particularly black children in rural areas, whose dignity remains far from being fully realized under our constitutional dispensation. And despite a court judgment being handed down on Monday which fully recognizes that the state absolutely failed in its obligations, unfortunately, to provide decent, adequate, safe sanitation in schools, not just in Michael's school, but in schools throughout Limpopo province, and we know also in other provinces as well. Despite finding that, and despite, by the way, making it a decent order on the government to eradicate unsafe and inadequate sanitation, at the same time, the judgment completely fails to recognize the suffering and the grief of the Komape family, who have experienced unemployment, who have experienced abuse, who have experienced the worst kind of trauma of losing a child in horrific circumstances and the pressure of being in the public eye that's resulted from the exposure this case has given them, and all of those things, the judge basically tries to rule out their suffering based on a technicality, a legal technicality. And, you know, that's for us, maybe, you know, this judgment really brings out some of the contradictions of modern-day South Africa. On the one hand, we have this constitution, which is so full of promise, so full of rights and obligations and duties, as Judge Yakub said. But on the other, we are failing in many areas to implement even the most basic principles of that constitution, of which dignity is absolutely 100%. Part.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm going to let it go there. And congratulations on the excellent work you guys do. I hope if there are corporates listening, you constantly ask me, often on the side of events, what can we do to prop up democratic process as well? What you can do is support organizations like Section 27. It's a shame in our fight for freedom that organizations that do the kind of work that they do should be struggling to be able to survive from an economic point of view. We'll take a bit of a break, and then I'm going to come back to my guests in studio. And I want to talk next about freedom when it comes to particularly gender relations in this country, the space we take up as men, and the kinds of unfreedom that many women still have to experience as a result of patriarchy.
Eusebius Makaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Still with me is Judge Yakub Bandile Ngiri, and then, of course, my two guests here in the studio, Nolwazi Tusini and Pearl Totseti. One of the things that fascinated me as a philosophy student, and it came back for me when I interviewed the brilliant Professor Christie van der Westhuizen on the positionality in our society of white, middle-class Afrikaans women, is the idea of space, partly because of the title of a book, Sitting Pretty. And I was thinking to myself, this is so fascinating. I wonder how women experience freedom or unfreedom in this country. And everything from garden variety examples, when I just sprawl myself as a man out in public space. Mm. You guys don't have much space. Mm. So you often have unfreedom economically in terms of job opportunities, getting the top jobs, to also physical space that sometimes seems to be limited. You don't have much space to comport, whereas I can just wrap myself all around both of you.
And I think that women are socialized into taking up less space. Mm. And then beyond that socialization, we then teach ourselves to take less space because sometimes you don't want to draw attention to yourself because drawing attention to yourself can sometimes put you in danger. So women then take up smaller and smaller and smaller bits of public spaces, and you see it in restaurants, in parks, in libraries. Women physically take up very, very little space for various reasons, because we're taught we shouldn't take up space. Mm. And also because adulthood, being an adult woman in this country, teaches you that it's better not to take up space, not to draw attention to yourself.
And when we do it, we're being assertive, Pearl. When you do it, it's a case of uya papa, not just physical space, but also discursive space.
Mm. Absolutely. Women always have to fold themselves. And we're constantly performing gymnastics, but it still has to be graceful, excuse me. So even in a corporate space, it's like there are a lot of men who will say that, oh, the reason a lot of women do not advance far up the ladder is because they're not assertive enough. But then when you're assertive, you are insulted and you're called
the B word.
The B word.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, what are you supposed to do? It's like constantly just trying to walk a tightrope all the time.
And I also think I've been thinking a lot about how I don't have mental space. Mental real estate is what I call it as a woman. I don't have mental real estate because I'm spending so much time either trying to stay safe, so scheming around ways on how I can keep my physical body space safe, my emotional body safe, and also scheming around how to get around the structural inequalities that are put in front of me. So be it in a corporate space or even in a social space. So I'm spending a lot of my mental real estate dealing with that. I don't have space to be imaginative. Absolutely. About certain things.
Judge Yakub and Bandile, I want to bring you guys back in here. Thank you for keeping quiet and practicing how to reduce patriarchal space. Bandile.
Okay, who you want?
I love it when great men are actually listening to women. Okay, hold on 1 second. The line's not great there, Bandile. Just Judge Yakub, I want you to do two things for me kindly, if you can, in the next minute or two. Firstly, just to engage this question of whether us as men do enough to reduce the amount of space we take up, all kinds of space, economic space, discursive space, physical space. But then I want you to complicate the conversation for us thereafter by also talking about people living with disability who also have certain kinds of unfreedom that we are not attentive to.
Mm. I think that 2% of the men in South Africa, or maybe a little more, in South Africa and in the whole world, try and do as much as they can to do this. The majority of men don't. The majority of men take up more space. They enjoy taking up more space. They pretend not to take up more space. They lie about the space they occupy.
Yes.
They supposedly create space for women, but at the same time create the space for themselves ultimately. And that is essentially the problem. It is the men. Mm. And that is why it's not only in this country, it's in the whole world that See, our constitution provides for equality. Our court says that everybody is equal. Our court says that men and women are equal to others. But the law can't cut it by itself. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I then come back to the need for this social revolution where us minority of men, I haven't got there yet, by the way, the struggle against sexism for me personally was a very, very difficult one. It's easy to say it. It's more difficult to achieve.
Mm.
I think that I just about got there some 30 years ago, but I still have to be very careful just in case I start slipping down the slippery slope again.
Mm.
So I really still have to be very careful. This sexism thing has been very, very difficult. So it's not enough to say that you're not non-sexist. You've got to go within yourself, within your heart, look at yourself quite carefully.
100%.
Admit where your failures are and work at them as hard as you can. And the same thing with disability. Because the two have a, you know, I still have a situation where if I'm standing alone somewhere, hardly anybody would come and talk to me because there's no eye contact.
Mm.
So people are not prepared to invest in vulnerable people.
Mm.
Our society still remains the survivor for himself, and I mean this quite deliberately, each man for himself and God for all.
Absolutely.
And they mean God for all men, not for women either.
Brilliantly put. Absolutely. Thank you, Judge Yacoub.
And it's a very serious problem. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your restful long weekend, Judge Yacoub, and for being part of this conversation and always so incisive. Bandile, I'm sorry the line messed up there, but your final thoughts?
My final thoughts sort of back to a conversation I was having with some of my friends when the men are trash hashtag really blew up. And it's about sort of what's the way forward is. I think at this stage, we are past the stage of sort of raising awareness. In an internet age, in an age where these discussions are happening everywhere, I think the real onus on men is to do work that really creates social consequences.
Yes.
for sexism. I was relating to like a friend, and the analogy I really liked was on the sports boycott during apartheid, to say there came a time where there was, you know, enough information, awareness raising, campaigning, that sort of your conventional work to try and end apartheid.
Mm.
But there came a point where, you know, all men who, even if they didn't see themselves directly, as white people in apartheid who didn't see themselves directly as perpetrators of apartheid but were beneficiaries, had to feel the pain.
Yes.
And so you had to create the social consequences, because there's a limit to how much education you do, and you'll often find that the most oppressive men are the men who sit every day and read everydayfeminism.com and can quote Audre Lorde better than women. what Pumla Gola calls feminators. And so the solution there is to say to men, look, in your private spaces, while we're having drinks around the braai, in boardrooms, that little jab, that little calling out someone is actually the work you need to be brave enough to do.
100%.
And it's precisely not a matter of information anymore.
Yeah.
It's about bravery. It's about responsibility. It's about taking the knock, even if you don't feel you are an active, horrible, monstrous perpetrator of sexism. And that's the way we need to move forward. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've run out of time. Thank you, Bandile. Excellent as always. And for teaching me a new neologism via Pumla Gola. Never heard that one before. And thanks so much to both of you. Pearl, I know you wanted to come in. We've run out of time, but we'll have you on the show again. And Nolwazi as well. You guys have been awesome.
Thank you for having us.